Hello and welcome to the Food Medic podcast. I'm Dr. Hazel Wallace, founder of the Food Medic. I'm a qualified doctor, personal trainer, blogger, and best-selling author of the books The Food Medic and The Food Medic for Life. I'm passionate about maximizing our health through how we live our lives, including the food that we eat, physical activity, and stress management. We will hear from leading experts in their field who will be sharing evidence-based advice on how we can live healthier lives, and we will cut through the confusing information that we find online. I like to think of myself as one of the first of a new generation of doctors. Hello and welcome to the Food Medic podcast. I'm Dr. Hazel Wallace. Today I'm very excited to introduce my first guest, Anita Bean, who is an award-winning registered nutritionist, published author, health writer, and former British bodybuilding champion. She is accredited by the Association of Nutrition, specializes in sports and exercise nutrition, and is passionate about helping athletes improve their performance. Anita has also authored 28 books, including The Complete Guide to Sports Nutrition, The Vegetarian Athlete's Cookbook, and The Runner's Cookbook. Wow, what an impressive intro. Anita, welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, I'm so glad to have you here. You are my first guest, and I'm very excited about it, but I would love if we could just start off by you sharing with our listeners how you got into sports nutrition.
I first got into nutrition because that stems from my love for food. Even as a child, as I was growing up, I was always experimenting with different ways of putting food together. I was always in the kitchen and cooking and trying to create recipes. And at school, I was fascinated by science. I was pretty good at science, as it happens. And so merging my passion for food and my love for science seemed to be a logical way to go. But in those days, and we're talking about the 1970s and 80s, there were not many courses around. But I did a course in nutrition and food science at the University of Surrey. And at the time, unusually for girls, I started lifting weights. I know nowadays a lot of girls are in the gym, but I was actually the only girl in the gym for very many years. And but that did trigger my curiosity to find out how nutrition can affect your athletic performance, how it can affect your body composition. And in those days, there was very little information around on sports nutrition, whereas nowadays, there's too much. It's quite confusing. So throughout my university studies, I continued to lift weights and I eventually got into bodybuilding competitions, which I did over 10 years. And during that time, I was able to use my knowledge in nutrition and kind of, if you like, experiment myself. But I was a qualified nutritionist. I was also working with very many athletes in different sports. I worked for a short time in the NHS. I also worked for a short time in the food industry. And then I set up my own nutrition consultancy. So I became a nutrition practitioner, sports nutritionist. And that was about 25 years ago. Sports-wise, I personally went on to win the British Bodybuilding Championships. And I did the World Championships after that.
Wow.
Don't worry, I've since retired. And, I've kind of gone on to have a more normal life. Because actually, if you're a bodybuilder, it does take over your life. It's quite an unusual lifestyle. And there are ugly sides to the sport. But since then, as a practitioner, I have gone on to write quite a number of books. In fact, my first book was The Complete Guide to Sports Nutrition.
Yeah.
That came out in 1993. That does sound like a long time ago, but I have updated it regularly since then. And as you
I have your updated version, and it's great. It's really great.
Thank you. Well, it's been updated 8 times. You know, it's really important to keep current.
Absolutely.
I've written a number of books, but the reason I wrote the book way back then was because there was a complete lack of information, certainly solid evidence-based information out there for athletes. I was working with a number of very high-profile track and field athletes, actually, as well as some bodybuilders, and they didn't have a clue. They were just guessing. They were just sort of eating food that filled them up,
yeah,
hoping for the best. But there were a lot of myths around. I don't think many of those myths have changed, no, quite honestly, over time.
And that's something I would love to discuss with you today, because I think everyday nutrition is a completely different kettle of fish to sports nutrition.
Mm.
And we may, I mean, the listeners may not be athletes themselves, but most people are working out or are interested in working out and staying well and how they can fuel their training. So what I would love to ask, and something that a lot of my followers have been asking, is what should I eat before and after I exercise? And should I be eating in between? And I think you're the best person to answer this question. I know that's a big question, but we could break it down.
No, that's the most logical question to ask, actually. The ideal time to eat before exercise would be about 3 to 4 hours, because you need enough time for the food to become digested, absorbed into your body, travel to the muscles. If you eat too close to exercise, you'll just feel very uncomfortable. The food energy won't be used by the muscles because it hasn't been delivered there. The kind of foods that you want to be eating, though, in the pre-exercise period would be foods that are fairly high in carbohydrate, particularly if you are going to be doing high intensity exercise. But you also want to include some protein and some fat, obviously the healthy fats. The reason for that is that that will slow down the digestion, absorption and delivery of that carb to the muscle. So you don't want your blood sugar levels to be peaking too high or too soon. So you want sustained energy. So that's the objective. So let's not talk about nutrients. Let's talk about foods, the kind of foods. So if you're having a pre-exercise meal, as I said, you need to leave sufficient time for it to be mostly digested. So something like porridge would be fine. So if you're working out in the morning, your breakfast could be porridge with fruit and nuts. If you are, on the other hand, exercising in the evening or maybe in the afternoon, your pre-exercise meal could be something like a pad thai with tofu. So that could include your noodles, your vegetables, your tofu. You've got all the right components, all the right nutrients are in there. That will give you lots of energy. Other examples I can give you would be something like a turkey spaghetti bolognese. You could have a falafel wrap. Again, you've got all the right components.
So really just a good balanced meal. And how about training fasted? If you're training first thing in the morning, you don't really feel like breakfast, is this going to impede your performance?
Okay, so fasted training. Well, fasted training means you are training in a state of a low carbohydrate availability or glycogen availability. It sounds a bit of a mouthful. So the advantage of, or the potential advantage of doing that, means that you will force your body to burn more fat and less carbohydrate because there is less carbohydrate available. And we definitely know from studies that the body will be oxidizing, in other words, burning more fat during the exercise. So that sounds an attractive proposition for somebody who perhaps wants to control their body fat levels, want to lose weight, or you just want to not gain weight. But, and there is a big but, as with most things, it means that you may not be able to hit very high exercise intensities, or you may fatigue sooner than you would have done. So in other words, your overall calorie burn might be less. What you've really got to look at the end of the day is your calorie intake over 24 hours. So it's not just what you're burning in those 20 minutes, those 60 minutes of your workout. You've got to look at what you're eating afterwards. So it's the calorie balance that really counts. And I know there's a real fashion for, or a real trend for fasted training. That can work, but in terms of body composition, it's not the most important thing. So do whatever feels right for you. But I think perhaps I should say that if you haven't eaten for about 3 or 4 hours prior to a workout, then having a little bit of food, a little bit of carbs, so if you like a little healthy snack, about 30 to 60 minutes.
Like a banana or...
Exactly. So that can raise your blood sugar level just a little bit. That will allow you to exercise at a higher intensity and for longer before you experience fatigue. So a pre-exercise snack, yeah, of course, a banana, it could be a handful of dried fruit and nuts, it could be peanut butter on toast.
Okay.
So all of those things would be suitable.
And then how about in the post-workout period? Do we need to be downing a protein shake as soon as the last dumbbell hits the floor?
Yes, and we see that all the time in the gym, don't we? People even go around with a protein shake in their hand as they're training. So a few years ago, most of the evidence seemed to suggest that there is this two-hour post-exercise recovery window. And we know that glycogen, that's a carbohydrate, is replenished faster during this immediate post-exercise period. And protein, again, if you consume protein in this period of time, you get a sharper rise in your blood levels of amino acids. However, the latest research shows that actually, unless you are training within 8 hours, again, so in other words, unless you're doing a dual workout that day, which really only very serious athletes would do, it's less important, because this post-exercise recovery goes on over very many hours. It goes on over 24 hours. So it's really what you consume over those 24 hours that is the most critical thing, is getting your carb goals, meeting your protein goals, meeting your fat goals and the calorie goals. That's the most critical thing. So you don't need to be consuming this protein shake or this post-workout smoothie immediately after exercise. Oh, you can't, it won't do any harm whatsoever, but it's not critical unless you are training later on in the day. So, for example, many of the swimmers whom I advise, they are training early in the morning and they're also training in the evening or late afternoon. So they will need to take advantage of the post-exercise two-hour window.
Okay. But for the most of us who are just training casually, we don't need to worry about any time constraints there. And in terms of post-workout meals, does that differ to pre-workout meals? Do we need to be upping our protein?
Okay, that's a good question. It isn't hugely different. So a few years ago, the main emphasis was on replenishing carbohydrate after endurance exercise. But we now know that actually combining carbs and protein. So an example I can give you would be, say, a milk-based drink or a yogurt bowl. So yogurt with fruit, with nuts and seeds. We now know that combining those ingredients together will actually give your body everything that it needs. It can promote glycogen refueling. It can promote muscle protein synthesis. That means the repair of muscle fibers that are broken down during exercise, as well as building new muscle. So it's really, it's a similar composition. It's the carbs, it's the protein, and it's getting those nutrients from healthy food combinations.
So what people should take away from this is focusing on protein and carbs pre and post workout, but not worrying too much about the timing of that. So we've discussed what we should eat before and after we exercise. How about in between exercise? If we're not doing endurance training, just working out in the gym, lifting weights, or maybe going for like a 5K run, should we be eating or drinking anything then?
During the exercise. Mm. So there is no value to consuming anything other than water if you're exercising for less than 60 to 90 minutes. So it's really only the serious forms of exercise that you should think about taking on board carbohydrates. So if you're in the gym for an hour, if you're out jogging for 30 minutes, 40 minutes, all you would really need would just be water, and then you'd only be drinking to thirst for those types of workouts.
Yeah. So when we see people in the gym with these like colourful drinks like BCAAs and various drinks.
Oh, yes.
We don't need to worry about them, do we?
No, there is so much hype about these, you know, pre-workout and during workout drinks. Very little evidence to support branched chain amino acids unless you are in a state of calorie deficit. So that means that if you are really dieting hard, perhaps going for a bodybuilding competition. But I think for most people in the gym, there is no value to take branched chain amino acids before or during the workout. Yeah. And that there was a study that was published very recently that has shown that you will get greater gains, greater muscle gains, in other words, by consuming a whole protein source, you know, the protein from an actual food as opposed to an amino acid supplement.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting. And I feel like that applies to most supplements. You know, the benefits we get from the whole food is just, you cannot get that in a pill. Which brings me on to my next point on protein supplementation, because I would love to get your views on it, whether you think it's necessary. is it useful?
Okay, so if you are exercising regularly, and by that I mean more than 3 times a week, your protein needs will be greater than that of couch potato. Mm. And the current evidence is that we will need, you know, roughly double that of non-exercisers. So somewhere between 1.2 and 2 grams per kilogram body weight, if you like numbers.
Mm.
I think they're quite scary, actually. I don't want people to get too hung up on them.
But I agree.
I think that if you ensure that you include some protein in each meal, ideally in each snack as well. So a snack could be something like peanut butter on toast, it could be a handful of nuts, it could be hummus with vegetables. It's quite easy to get enough protein in your diet, provided you're not, you know, following some, you know, the latest trend in or having a restrictive diet that excludes certain food groups. Now, do you need protein supplements? Not if you are already consuming
enough
from your food and you're having balanced meals. Really, the only advantage of a protein supplement, such as the whey supplement, would be convenience. So it's a portable form of protein. So if you don't want to sit down and have, I don't know, eggs or something like a cheese sandwich or your hummus on toast after workout, and you find it's more convenient to take it in liquid form, then that's fine. Whey has got one or two advantages in that it's a fast absorbed protein, and secondly, it is high in an amino acid called leucine, which has been shown to trigger muscle protein synthesis, as well as being an essential amino acid itself. But you can, of course, get leucine from most protein sources, so certainly dairy proteins, fish.
For vegan protein supplementation, is it the same principle?
Well, vegan protein supplements will contain lower levels of the essential aminos, and they'll contain lower levels of leucine. So they're not, it's not devoid in those. So the way to get enough protein as a vegan, and it's perfectly possible to do that, is either by upping your portion sizes or by combining different types of protein.
Yeah.
And we definitely know from studies that it is possible to do that. But as a vegan, you just need to be a lot more mindful and a lot more knowledgeable, really, about food.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a huge myth around being vegan or having plant-based sources of protein and that it's almost impossible, but it's not, because we know that, you know, there's protein in whole grains and like beans and lentils. What other protein sources can we give to our listeners that are plant-based?
Okay, you're quite right, Hazel. You can get all the protein that you need as a plant-based athlete. Mm. And there are plenty of examples, actually, of high-profile athletes now. Lewis Hamilton, Venus Williams, they're all vegan, actually. They are also very strong, very muscular.
Mm.
So you can get all the protein that you need from pulses, such as beans and lentils. Soya and soya products will contain all of the essential amino acids there. So if you include soya regularly in your diet, you're definitely on the right track. And actually a lot of soya products, the drinks, the yogurts and so on, they are fortified with calcium and the B vitamins to a similar level that you'd find in the dairy equivalent. You can also get your protein from nuts and seeds and hemp seeds, for example. That is a complete source of protein, although the others less so.
Mm.
And you can get protein from nut butters, obviously very trendy, but that's a very convenient way of adding a little bit of extra protein to your diet. So really the key is to combine all of those foods. So for example, you could have a chickpea and spinach curry with rice, or you could have something that I like doing a lot is quinoa mixed with different types of beans. You can make burgers out of beans, black bean burgers, chickpea burgers, and then you can combine that with grains. You can add in some tahini, or you can add in some nut butter, and then you've got a complete form of protein.
Absolutely. So I guess the takeaway is to combine your proteins, variety, and up the portion size as well, so you're getting enough protein there.
Perfect.
But I guess protein shakes would be useful in that scenario as well. I know I personally use them, but for me it's like convenience, you know.
Absolutely.
If I can't get home and grab lunch that soon, protein shake's ideal. And I think for a lot of people that's the same. But like you said, you don't have to have it, you know, you can have a perfectly healthy diet and meet all your protein needs through food.
Yeah.
The other nutrient that's quite topical in the sports nutrition world is carbohydrates. And I know that a lot of athletes now are kind of trying out low carbohydrate diets. But in my mind, I'm thinking, does that not impede their performance? And I would love to know your take on this.
Yes, low carb diets, I do get asked a lot of questions about this. It's become such a strong trend over the last 4, 5, 6 years. Now, the reason why some athletes and gym goers are looking at low carbohydrate diets is because when you train with low carbohydrate availability, you are teaching or training the muscles to burn fat more efficiently. So in other words, you're forcing the body to burn more fat and less glycogen because there's less carbohydrate available. And the second thing that's happening is that you are enhancing the endurance training adaptations. The studies have actually measured an increase in the number of mitochondria, and these are the powerhouses of the cells. So these are the parts of the cells that burn body fat and really are more responsible for training adaptations. So when people follow a low carbohydrate diet and they train as well, what happens, we know from the studies that they do get an increase in mitochondria, there's an increase in gene expression, increase in cell signaling. However, and this is a big however, studies so far have failed to show an advantage in terms of performance with low carb diets. And certainly when it comes to race performance, when it comes to performing high level exercise, so that means anything above about 75% of your maximal aerobic capacity. So that's quite hard exercise. What happens there is that you're actually hampering the body's breakdown of carbohydrates. So it becomes like a double-edged sword. You're literally knocking out your top gear. It means that you are less able to produce energy fast. You see, carbohydrate is a fast fuel. You can get approximately 25 to 30 calories per minute, whereas with fat, it's only about 6 calories per minute. So if you are doing, say, long distance running at a fairly slow to moderate intensity, or you're doing an ultra, then fat is absolutely fine as the fuel. If you want, you can follow a low carb diet if that suits you. It will save you carrying all those gels around with you. But if you are looking for high intensity, if you're looking for performance, if you're a competitive athlete, you will do better by having some carbohydrate, at least for your high intensity sessions. And in fact, now what we're looking at in both the research and in practice is something I call flexible fueling. And that means doing your low intensity sessions with low carbs, your high intensity sessions with higher carbs. It's what we call fueling for your workout. And you get the dual benefits, the best of both worlds. You get the fat burning advantages and you get the performance advantages of the high carbohydrate.
We briefly touched on supplementation when we spoke about protein and BCAAs. Are there any supplements that you feel we should be including in our repertoire when it comes to training?
Okay, very good question. In fact, only about a month ago, the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, assessed all of the evidence relating to supplements. Mm-hmm. And what they found, perhaps not surprisingly, that there are is just a very small handful of supplements that's actually backed up by solid evidence that will actually work. So these include caffeine, they include creatine and possibly beta-alanine, but the vast majority of the others out there, they're not backed up by the science.
Yeah.
They're more sizzle rather than substance. So I'm quite happy to give you the top line on each of those supplements.
Yeah, I think definitely a lot of people are super interested about creatine. I know I've been asked about it a lot. So it would be really interesting if you could tell us what it is and what would be the benefits of including it and who may need to include it or it might be in their benefit too.
Okay, so creatine is possibly the most well-researched sports supplement out there. It's a protein, it's made up of amino acids, and what it does, it raises the body's levels of phosphocreatine in the muscles. Now, this is a high-energy compound that is used to generate energy or ATP during high-intensity exercise. So it can be helpful when you are performing high-intensity bursts of exercise, sprints, lifts in the gym, particularly if you're doing repeated sets. So obviously the gym training environment is one of the most common ways that this supplement is used, but it's also used extensively by athletes who are doing, you know, repeated high intensity bursts. So it's been well researched for about 20 years, and it has indeed been shown to increase strength, to help maintain high intensity power output, and also to aid recovery between sets, and ultimately lead to increases in body mass and body strength, particularly with sports where, you know, strength and muscle are critical. So the optimal dose, you can either achieve that by consuming about 20 grams per day for 5 days. That's what's often used in the studies for quickness. However, I think a preferable method is by doing a longer period of loading, so roughly 4 or 5 grams per day over about 20 days, 28 days. So you have a more gradual loading protocol. So that has been shown to be beneficial. There are very few downsides. There is no actual evidence to show that creatine has got any side effects.
Mm-hmm.
In the short term, we know that some athletes experience water retention.
Maybe
unwanted weight gain, perhaps in people who are competing in sports where they don't want the additional weight. So, for example, in runners, they might not want the additional weight because there is a certain amount of water drawn into the muscles.
And just putting this into context for people, if you are not looking for, you know, like you're not doing any powerlifting or it's not from a performance standpoint, it's not going to impede your training not having this in, like, taking this supplement every day. It's literally just an extra if you are looking to go that, I guess, extra mile, really, isn't it?
It's the icing on the cake.
Yeah.
Most definitely. It won't turn you from, you know, ordinary Joe Bloggs into a bodybuilder.
Arnie in the morning.
No. We're talking about, you know, something like a maximum of 8-10% increase in strength over quite a long period of time. So it's not going to make a huge difference. It's measurable in research terms, but
yeah.
I think for most people, and this is so important for people to understand, what you do in gym should be supported by a good solid foundation of your diet. That is the most important thing, is getting your day-to-day nutrition right, getting the timing right. So it's getting the amounts, the variety right. And then the supplements, whether it's creatine that you're using, whether it's caffeine or anything else, they are simply the icing on the cake.
Yeah. And you mentioned caffeine. I mean, I love a cup of coffee and I will usually have one before I go to the gym, but I'm not really into caffeine supplementation. And my question to you is, can we get the same benefits from a mug of coffee, or do we need to be taking a supplement?
And that is a question that has actually been addressed in the research, and we know that both coffee and caffeine will have the same or at least very similar effects. So caffeine has been well researched as well. It's been shown to work for both endurance as well as strength exercise. It's a stimulant, so it acts on the brain, the central nervous system. It works by blocking the action of a brain chemical called adenosine, which would normally make you feel tired and sleepy. So if you can block that, instead of feeling sleepy, you'll then feel more alert. And caffeine will reduce your perception of effort and fatigue. So that means that it's easier to keep going. You know, your exercise feels easier. And indeed, we know from the research that people will experience greater endurance effects, better performance enhancement as a result of taking caffeine. So whether you choose to take that from caffeine or pills is up to you. The advantage, though, of taking pills would be that you know exactly what you're taking, whereas in coffee, it could be anything from, say, 50 milligrams from a cup of instant up to 200 or more from, say, a double espresso that you'd buy from a coffee shop. So you don't really know what you're getting.
No, I think my concern around caffeine supplementation is also the negative effects. And, you know, the half-life is what, it's 7 hours?
Yeah.
So if you're having it late in the day or even at lunchtime, that could be impeding you falling asleep later on.
definitely. Yeah, a couple of caveats actually with caffeine. Firstly, I never recommend it to under 18s because it hasn't been researched in terms of performance. But I have so many teen athletes who ask me, you know, they start taking caffeine, whether it's in pill form or drink form. Yeah. But the second thing is you've got to remember that it stays in the body for a long time, as you've rightly said, and it can increase sleeplessness and, you know, it can also increase anxiety, trembling. So there are negative side effects of caffeine. Everybody responds differently. We know that there are certain genes actually that make us more predisposed to using caffeine or breaking it down more readily. So not everybody will benefit, and some people it can actually have a negative effect. The research indicates that the ergogenic effect, that's the beneficial effect, is around about 3 milligrams per kilogram body weight. So that means an average size woman who weighs 60 kilos would need something like 180 milligrams to get a marked beneficial effect in terms of performance. So that's quite a lot of caffeine, really, but it varies so much from person to person. What I need might be different from what you need.
Absolutely.
And it's at the end of the day, it's trial and error as to what will really work.
We all know that person who can drink coffee. I'm that person who can drink coffee and go straight to sleep. And then there's some people who just need to sniff it and then they're bouncing off the walls. And that again is down to that genetic predisposition, whether you metabolize it fast or slow. And I guess the other benefits of having a cup of coffee is because we know when it comes from, like, because coffee itself has so many polyphenols as well, and antioxidants, so plant chemicals that can benefit your gut bacteria and have other properties. So I guess there's pros and cons to both there, and it depends on what you're looking for, what your goals are.
Exactly.
And now I've got a couple of nutrition myths, because I'm a huge fan of myth busting, and I know there's so many in the sports nutrition world, and I'm only going to have time to cover a few with you, but one of them that I come up quite a bit, especially in the bodybuilding world, is the more protein you eat, the more muscle you will gain. Is this true?
It's so tempting to believe that just because a little bit is good, the more has got to be better. So there is an optimal level, and we know from studies for most people, this is roughly 25 to 30 grams per meal. It doesn't mean that the rest will be discarded. If you consume any more than that, you'll still absorb it. It's just that it will be turned into an energy source. So having more, it doesn't mean that you'll then use it all to build more muscle. It will just be used as a potential source of energy, which you may or may not need. So it's just, there is no advantage really of having more than you need.
Okay, that's really great. So we just need to get our minimum requirements for the day. It doesn't matter if we go a little bit over, but going maximum on the protein isn't going to give us big muscle gains in the morning.
No, you'd be better off really looking at the distribution of your protein throughout the day, ensuring that you have fairly even-sized amounts at breakfast, lunch, dinner, and including some in your snacks. So roughly 25 to 30 grams per meal would suit most people. Bigger people need more than smaller people because they've got a larger muscle mass. But if you have too much protein, you're really just having more than your body really needs.
Yeah. And another thing I hear from women in particular is eating protein is going to make me bulky.
No, if only it was that simple. I'm talking now as a former bodybuilding athlete. Overconsuming protein definitely won't make you bulky or give you those big muscles. The only way that you can build muscle is through intense and consistent weight training or resistance training coupled with an adequate amount of protein. And consuming more won't give you those big muscles. But I should also say at this point, it's very difficult for women to get big bulky muscles anyway. So even if you trained every single day in the gym with heavy weights, you as a woman, we don't have enough testosterone in the male anabolic hormones naturally to allow us to do that. So we will end up see with more muscle mass, but it's nothing like those big bulky muscles. And when you see that in the magazines, that's really due to, you know, some women will be taking steroids. It's probably not an area that you really need to talk about on this show, but there is an ugly side to sport.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's something I don't think a lot of people are aware of, because, you know, what you see online isn't necessarily the truth.
No.
And something I cover in my book is egg yolks, and egg yolks are bad for you, and cover that myth. But going the egg yolk versus egg white kind of whole thing is very big in the bodybuilding world. Read some, you know, recent evidence on this, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it. And should we be cutting out our egg yolks, and is egg whites going to give us, you know, a better kind of, are we going to build more muscle through just having egg white?
And this is actually a very long-standing myth. Even in my days when I was competing in bodybuilding, bodybuilders were flinging out those egg yolks. And in fact, a very good study was published less than a year ago, in fact, where they compared the muscle-building effects of whole eggs versus egg whites, and they actually found there were greater gains to be had from the whole egg, the whole food source, as opposed to extracting the yolk. And as you know, Hazel, because the yolk is jam-packed with other useful nutrients. Yeah. Apart from protein, it also contains healthy fats as vitamin D, vitamin A, vitamin E, and a whole host of useful minerals. So there's no point just, you know, getting rid of a really good, nutritious food.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know other people will have been concerned about it from a cholesterol standpoint. And we now know that, you know, the dietary cholesterol in an egg yolk isn't something that we need to be concerned about. It's not going to raise our blood cholesterol. I think that's all that we have time to cover, but something that I'd love to finish the podcast on is if you could give people three things that they can do today to improve their health. And it doesn't have to be food related. It can be anything that you feel can add to their life.
Okay. These are the things that I do. Three things that I do. Firstly, I am very consistent about exercise. So I make activity or exercise part of my daily routine. The important thing is that you show up, you do something that you like. Don't do too much too soon. If you do that, I mean, everybody falls down that trap, particularly when you're young. You've got ambitious training goals, you want to get there really soon, but you could end up being injured. And I see that so much, and also burnt out. And I've seen that a lot as well.
Yeah.
So just be consistent,
a little bit every
day. Ambitious. The second thing that I do, well, I'm vegetarian. I don't think that, I mean, I've been vegetarian from birth, so that's just been a normal way of eating for me. But I think that everybody would benefit by having a more plant-based diet, so switching more to plants and perhaps eating a little bit less meat. But we already know that from the surveys that actually one in three people have already been cutting down on their meat intake over the past year.
Yeah.
But I don't think you need to be fully vegetarian or vegan to benefit. So having more vegetables, more pulses, more grains and more nuts and so on, you've got more fibre, you've got much greater diversity of nutrients that will benefit your gut health. We know that can also benefit athletic performance, actually, amongst about 100 other benefits of having good, you know, good gut
health. It really does. It's like such an upcoming area.
It is.
We just haven't even tapped on it.
Yeah, of course.
But yeah, I love those two, first two. So move every day and plant-based, going more plant-focused, I guess. And your third one?
My third tip, and this is something that I've recently got into over the last year, is that I practice mindfulness meditation for 10 minutes every day. And I have found enormous benefits from that. First, I used to think, oh, this is just something that rather alternative people do. But in fact, it trains your attention.
Absolutely.
It helps me to, you know, let go of stuff in the past, things that have already gone on that you can no longer do anything about. But importantly, it helps me to reduce anxieties. It teaches me to be present in the moment and to enjoy the present moment more. It teaches me acceptance, and it teaches me to be more kind to myself and kind to other people. And though I think those are all important qualities, it's so easy to forget in our busy lives. And I think 10 minutes of, you know, doing mindfulness meditation with an app, I do use an Calm app.
I like Calm as well.
I tried
Headspace for a while, but Calm is my favourite. And I love their sleep stories as well if I'm struggling to fall asleep.
And the music. I love the music from the app as well.
So I love those 3 points. And I think that's something that everyone can try today and try to kind of, I guess, it's a little interventions that you can do every day to improve your health. And again, like we said, it's not all about food. It's mindfulness and movement as well. Thank you so much for joining us today. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. And I am very honoured to be your first guest.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell everyone where we can find you?
Okay, you can find my website, which is anitabean.co.uk.
Mm-hmm.
You can find me on Twitter and you can find me on Instagram.
Amazing. I will link all of them in the show notes anyway. But thank you everyone for listening, and make sure to tune in next time for our next episode. Thank you so much for tuning into the Food Medic podcast. Please do subscribe so that you are the first to hear about any new episodes. And if you are enjoying them, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review so that we can reach as many people as possible. Check out my website, thefoodmedic.co.uk, where you can find tons of recipes and articles. Follow me on social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at The Food Medic. And my new book, The Food Medic for Life, is out now, which is packed full of loads of recipes, nutritional advice, myth-busting, and feature pages on topics such as sleep and mindfulness. You can grab both my books on Amazon or in any good bookstore. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time.